Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
The term conservative covers an awful lot of ground in Canada. There are countless factions that exist under that label: regional, ideological, fiscal. And the question at any time is how much these various factions can actually agree on. Right now, there are at least two things. First, the approach that the Conservative Party of Canada used in last year's federal election didn't work. And second, neither did the leader.
An unexpected fall from grace for the leader of the official opposition.
I will be resigning as the leader of the Conservative Party of Canada.
Months after losing an election many thought should have been won by the Conservatives, Andrew Scheer is throwing in the towel.
So now, the party finds itself searching for both a new spokesperson as well as perhaps a new direction. But which direction? And who will do the speaking? And just how close to impossible will that person's job be? Because if the Conservative Party is to have a hope of forming a majority government federally, then all those factions need to agree on a lot more than just don't do the same thing we did last time. And that's a lot of tightropes for one person to walk, whoever it is. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Bob Plamondon is the author of a number of books about the Conservative Party of Canada. He's written about where it succeeded and where it's fallen short. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Why don't you start, I guess, since we're talking about succeeding and falling short. Can you explain a little bit about how it can seem to be so easy for Conservatives to win provincial elections, but so tough to win a federal one?
Well, you know, that's it's quite a challenge. We can certainly see that federally, since the days of Sir John A. Macdonald, the Conservative Party has done abysmally on the federal scene. 68 of the last 100 years have been won by the Liberal Party. In fact, they call themselves, and even Conservatives acknowledge, that they have become the natural party of government. So, you know, it is not the norm that Conservatives win federally. Often it's either they get the rare alchemy of leadership and issue management, and they gain confidence of the Canadian people, or more often than not, it's that the country is tired of Liberal administrations and they're looking for change, and so the Conservatives become interregnums in effect between Liberal administrations. And the odd part about that is you're quite right, they have been successful provincially, not just in, you know, Ontario and the West and Atlantic Canada, but for long periods of time. In Ontario, you know, for example, they went, you know, over 40 consecutive years in power. Where they have struggled provincially has been in Quebec, but that's not because the debate has been sort of left-right between conservatism and liberalism. It's been between nationalism and separatism. So I would say Quebec is distinct in that way. But I think why they have been, you know, for example, more successful in Ontario and even in Atlantic Canada is that they have generated a brand of conservatism that is uniquely positioned to meet the needs of the particular province. Where conservatives get into trouble is when they're trying to reconcile what does conservatism mean in different parts of the country, and it means different things. So, for example, in Prince Edward Island, if you are a conservative, you're very much sensitive, and I would say in Nova Scotia as well, you're very much sensitive to environmental issues, you know, more so than you might get in other parts of the country. In some parts of the country, if you look out west, social conservatism is particularly strong and robust and has quite a following. It's far less so in Ontario and virtually non-existent in Quebec. So it's reconciling those differences of opinion, which is tougher for conservatives because they are a party that has an underlying collection of ideologies that they try to bring together, whereas the Liberal Party has a little bit more flexibility in that they, you know, they on some issues they might go left, other issues they might go, you know, to the right, or they would try to find dead center and hope that that works. So it's reconciling, you know, different factions and ideologies that have been a challenge for conservatives.
So we're going to talk about how that could impact the leadership race in a minute. But I guess one of the things I'm interested in is how much of that problem that you just described is sort of intractable and just the nature of politics in Canada, and how much of that could be addressed by a new leader, a new strategy, a change of approach.
Well, I don't think there are any obstacles, fundamental, inherent, that cannot be overcome, and they have been overcome. So we saw in 1984, Brian Mulroney won, you know, the largest majority government of all time, and he repeated that in 1988, and he did so not just by scooping up seats in, you know, in Ontario and Quebec or pitting one region against the other. This was a truly national government. So he succeeded. Stephen Harper was able to win seats in all parts of the country, less so in Quebec, and again, that is distinct because of the presence of the Bloc Québécois. So he was able to achieve it, and what a strong national leader for the Conservative Party does is effectively represent the conservative universe in the widest possible way to draw as many of the elements working together in common cause. Now, what that means is that there may be some social conservatives who want something. Let's say on their wish list, they've got 10 things and they may only get two or three, but it's two or three things on their list that they wouldn't get from a Liberal Party. So better to join with the Conservatives, not get all that they want, but get some of the things. And you can do that with almost any of the factions that exist. And even those people, and I would say that's the majority of people, who don't identify with ideology whatsoever, but are more concerned about the standard of living and quality of life. So when you have a leader who comes forward within the Conservative Party and is seen to represent one particular faction, and I'll give you two examples. Joe Clark, and he was successful he won the election, albeit as a minority in 1979, mm-hmm. was very much known as a Red Tory. And that diminished the enthusiasm. And in fact, not only was he a Red Tory, there were those who were on the social conservative spectrum that would have said that he was disrespectful towards them, that he diminished them. Brian Mulroney didn't do that. Andrew Scheer in the last election campaign was quite clearly identified as a social conservative. You went through his history, how he voted, how he was endorsed by Campaign Life Coalition. You know, he was very much from that that faction of the party. And so those who were either uncomfortable with that or, you know, were in other parts of the country that, you know, just didn't have those views, lost confidence or enthusiasm that he could bridge the gaps that were necessary to build a national coalition. So the challenge for you know, the next leader of the Conservative Party, you know, is to bring all those factions together, not to be a champion for one or the other, but to bring them together in common cause.
Has it become harder to bridge those gaps? I mean, this is anecdotally, obviously, from social media and elsewhere, but it seems that the social conservatives and the Red Tory moderate crowd have moved further away from one another over the past several years.
So I don't believe that it is. I think there's actually more consensus in Canada on social issues than there have been, you know, over the last 20 or 30 years. I mean, we used to have, obviously, there was big discussions and debates over capital punishment. And there was quite a divide, you know, across the country and within political parties and within movements. And but I think on many of the social issues, particularly same-sex marriage and the rights of LGBTQ, are now more universally accepted. So I think that the divides there are not as difficult to bridge. And, you know, if you come from the social conservative universe, you may not get from within the conservative leadership in the Conservative Party. That may not be your best vehicle for trying to influence public opinion. You can go outside a political party and join campaign life, or, you know, work through your church or try to influence public opinion that way. But, you know, you're not going to be successful, I believe, within the institution of the Conservative Party of Canada. That's not where your voice will be heard. But you may have particular views, for example, on the virtues of family life. And, you know, the Conservative Party might come forward with, for example, tax policies that are quite family friendly, that right. you would support, that give you more choice and flexibility in how you organize yourself for childcare, where, you know, the Liberal government might believe in a more institutionalized approach, and the Conservative government or Conservative Party may take a more flexible approach that social conservatives would find attractive, and this would also, you know, not offend more moderate or red Tories to have a party that supports traditional family values, and it doesn't offend the sensibilities of mainstream Canada. So, you know, in effect, you're picking and choosing from within the perspectives of these various factions across the country to find that sweet spot. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's certainly possible.
I know it's kind of early days. I mean, it's only been a little more than 6 weeks, I guess, since this leadership race really started. But from what you've seen so far, I guess, first of all, who are the front runners? And that might be kind of obvious, but also, what are you seeing in terms of lessons learned from the past election, as you mentioned Scheer's approach?
So, you know, if we had this conversation last week, I might have said there are five front runners.
Right.
And it was a pretty much of an open contest. You never know who might between now and the approaching deadline to register as a candidate, who might also, you know, enter the race, although it's you know, the list of people who are rumored even to be entering is shrinking by the day. It would seem that there's only two candidates that I can identify that have a prospect of building support across the country, and that's Peter MacKay and Erin O'Toole. And I think they are both trying to distance themselves quite decidedly from the approach and the style and the tactics that were used in the last election campaign, notably by Andrew Scheer, and his discomfort with able to answer very simple, straightforward questions on perspectives on social issues. So we saw this week Peter MacKay go out of his way to declare that he will march in the Gay Pride Parade in Toronto, and showing nothing but respect for that community, which lines up, in fact, with, you know, he was one of the very few cabinet ministers in the Harper government who voted to accept and embrace and endorse same-sex marriage. He was one of only, I think, six at the time. So this is a position that I think he has long held and was he can even readily embrace and be believable on the issue. Erin O'Toole, you know, came out also with position that he would march in a gay pride parade, but he put some qualifiers on it, you know, in terms of how the parade was organized and who was able to march. So I wonder if, you know, he's making the nod to the issue, but, you know, trying to make a to be somewhat cute with social conservatives to say, well, you know, I'm in it, but, you know, not in an unfettered way, or you know, maybe not as enthusiastically as Peter MacKay. But you can see that both of the leading candidates, and I think, you know, we will not see others enter the race, are moving, you know, on that issue. And there will be others, other issues where they're going to be questioned. And I would say climate change would be one of them.
So far, it seems that the discussion around this race has focused first mostly on you know, the social issues that we just talked about, and will they be different from Andrew Scheer's approach? And then also just about branding, as we saw kind of the rollout videos and talking about Canada's strong because Canadians are strong and that kind of stuff. When do you expect we'll see that change and the real policy to be discussed? And I guess, what do you think the key issues are that will decide how Conservatives choose their leader?
You know, when you talk about branding, you're really not, I take it, not talking so much about the brand of the Conservative Party. You're talking about the brand of the leader.
Yeah, trying to be that national figure.
What they represent, their approach. And I think that's just that's absolutely critical that we have leaders, and I'm talking about this for all political parties, who can connect with Canadians, who can connect with them on an emotional level, you know, who take the issues far more seriously than they take themselves. These are people you would want to sit down and have a, you know, a coffee or a beer with. There's a sense that they know and understand the country. You want to get a sense of their motivations, because you can put forward all the policies you want in the world and be very prescriptive about it. But as you become prime minister, you're going to be faced with hundreds of issues that are not part of your platform, that you've never talked about before, that, you know, events that emerge, and you want to have an essence of who that person is and what their instincts are and how they will react. I think that's, you know, that's more important than, you know, saying that, you know, a tax is going to be at a certain rate, or you're going to have a, you know, a particular policy on this pipeline versus another. So I think, to the extent that the campaign reveals who these people are, is as important or more is more important than the particular, you know, policies that come forward. Now, with that, I think they'll want to know what the candidate's instincts are on a few key policies. And, you know, always at the top of the list is you know, now that we've sort of set aside some hot button issues, such as, you know, what's your stand on gay rights? And I don't think that's going to be an issue in this campaign. But the economy is always number one. Now, I've argued that, you know, candidates and even leaders in the Conservative Party do themselves no favors when they talk about ideology as what they want to bring to Canadians. My view is, you know, Canadians want to hear about jobs. They want to hear about rising incomes. They want to hear about, you know, income security for the elderly. They want to hear about, you know, a government that has strong finances that can support social systems and health care and the aged. They're looking for responses to kitchen table issues that the Canadians will feel that they're going to make decisions that are in the best long-term interests of the country. The environment is going to be, I think, front and center. You know, how do you deal with climate change? What mechanisms, you know, do you propose? Is it investments in technology? Is it regulation? Is it taxation? You know, who is going to pay? And within that, within the, you know, climate change issue is also energy management. So I think the candidates will be expected to talk about the oil sands and the development of the oil sands and pipelines and enabling Canadian energy products to get to markets, how energy is distributed across Canada from the west to the east. And, you know, and here is, you know, one of the conundrums here, or one of the perplexing issues is, and I've written about this, how do you get people in Quebec, you know, who don't want pipelines, or the Atlantic Canadians who are, you know, deeply concerned about the environment, on the same page as the people who live in Fort McMurray and in British Columbia? How do you get them all on the same page? That will be a test of leadership that the candidates will be expected to answer.
I guess my last question, just in terms of two sides of speaking broadly to all Canadians and connecting with them, there's a couple of things that have come up. The first is, how does that include Quebec if the presumptive nominee is not bilingual? But also out in Alberta, where maybe not even just in Alberta, but out on the far end spectrum of the right, where, you know, climate change policies are not important and social conservative policies are, and they tend to be very vocal, even if they're not a huge part of the base. How do you walk both those lines, and do you worry about alienating any potential votes?
So, you know, no one wants to alienate potential votes, and you want a national government, so you've got to win seats in Quebec and in Alberta. you know, on the question of bilingualism, you know, I can think of even French leaders who's take Jean Chrétien, for example, who was, you know, vilified in Quebec because they didn't like the way that he spoke the language and,
right.
You know, it wasn't quite up to their standards. I would say that, you know, within Quebec, you know, it's the population is, let's call them, fair-minded and generous. I think if they see a candidate, who is able to speak to them in French, they can deliver a speech in French. You know, they can answer some, you know, questions in French with not gotcha questions with, you know, very complicated and convoluted French, but if basically they can get their message across and what their approach would be to the issues, even if they're not fluently bilingual, but the people of Quebec can see that you respect the language, you respect the culture, you respect the nation of the Quebecois, that your policies are supportive of that. You're not antithetical to Quebec. I think they would prefer that, for example, than a Francophone prime minister who diminishes Quebec rights. I don't think Pierre Trudeau has ever been forgiven for the patriation of the Constitution over the objections of the government of Quebec. They would have far preferred, you know, either a unilingual or a somewhat bilingual prime minister who didn't do that. So I think, you know, the respect is far more important. And I think we would see in both Peter MacKay and Aaron O'Toole the efforts that they're making, and their capacity in French will be strong enough to win support. But if you're going to make this an absolute test that you have to be a Francophone with complete and total fluency, I think that's, you know, that in effect is diminishing the pool of people who could become prime minister to a much narrower pool, and it's not in the national interest. In Alberta, and you know, on the far right, I mean, we've seen what happens when they feel alienated, and it's called the Reform Party, when they felt that the government of Mulroney was too close to Quebec and was, you know, giving favorable treatment on the awarding of contracts to, you know, a Quebec firm over a Western firm that planted a seed and started a fire that led to the Reform Party and the split of the Conservative movement. And Conservatives in Alberta are going to have to ask the question, who do you want as Prime Minister? Do you want Justin Trudeau, whose policies have clearly been rejected resoundedly in the West, or would you rather have a Conservative leader who, again, has to win votes in Quebec, has to win votes in Atlantic Canada and Ontario? You're not going to get everything that you want, but you'll have a leader that is more supportive of Alberta and Saskatchewan and energy development than you would get otherwise. And there's a number of things that a Conservative leader could do, which is to say, you know, for example, you know, we are going to develop resources, we are going to build pipelines, but the world is transitioning away from carbon-based fuels. And the economy of Western Canada over time is going to need to diversify. And we are, as a nation, going to help Western Canada with that process, not just to leave you with a tattered economy with no supports, but, you know, we'll be a partner along the way to support Western Canada. That message might resonate better than what they're getting today from Justin Trudeau.
And I guess we have a few months yet to see how this all sorts out.
We certainly do. And you know, the conversation might change quite dramatically over that period.
Thanks for your insight today.
My pleasure.
Bob Plamondon writes about the Conservative Party. That was the Big Story Podcast. If you'd like more, you know by now. You really should. TheBigStoryPodcast.ca or on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN will always have the links for you there 3 times a day. And we're in all your podcast feeds. At least we should be, because you should have by now subscribed and rated us with 5 stars and reviewed us to tell us what we should be covering. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.